Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City. Today we have an overpack show. I'll get as many of these issues in as possible. First, the latest on health and healing, as always, and state-of-the-art. We go to the original scientific references, so you get information that you're not reading in a local newspaper or hearing that's been filtered through frequently the self-censorship of not really going after big pharma. We're not promoting natural healing. We're going to do both. Then we're going to have a newsmaker, Scott Shackford, an associate editor of the 24/7 News at Reason.com. Very important website. Shackford comes to Reason.com after nearly a decade of serving in various editing positions for Freedom Communications, libertarian leading media chain that may or may not still exist depending upon when this prolific profile is in place. But we're going to talk today with Scott about a shooting that did not make the headlines yesterday. Needless to say, the one in Colorado is the one we're focusing on, but there was another shooting, and that was in California, where a group of people were simply peacefully protesting on private property, the police shooting an unarmed African-American in the back and killing him. And then what happened is just almost unbelievable. We'll be playing you the clip. You can watch it on our website. You can listen to it. It's short. And then we're going to do a discussion about the nature of overreaction by police. Then my guests in the second part of our program today are going to talk about an issue I believe is long overdue, the psychological dynamics of authoritarianism and its power as a threat to democracy. My guest will be Dr. Diana Alstad. She is an author. She is the Woodrow Wilson Fellow and from Yale University. She also was professor at Duke University in the humanities. And she taught the first women's studies courses at Yale and Duke. And she co-founded the New Haven Women's Liberation back in 1968. She'll be joined with her partner of almost 40 years, and he is here, Dr. Joel Kramer. He is the author of an early seminal work, The Passionate Mind. And he got his doctorate from NYU and Columbia, and so they'll both be here talking on this issue. Then I'm going to share with you, again, time permitting, about the debate, which is the best diet? You have all kinds of people out there now promoting the Weston Price diet, the paleo diet, the big meat eater's diet, the high animal protein diet. Well, there's a new article from Scientific America. And the Scientific American article by Rob Dunn goes into depth and, I believe, really answers the debate. Which diet is the best diet for us? A vegan diet or an animal-based diet? And that goes clear back millions of years. So that's going to be interesting. I'm not sure we'll have time, but I want to get to our issue of the day, which is Generation X on climate change. And according to Brett Israel of DailyClimate.org, the generation that is between the ages of, let's say, 30 and 50, they're so occupied with families and careers that they just don't have time nor interest in anything involving our climate. So we'll discuss that. A moment, however, to share something with you. This is about a person you may never have heard of. His name was Lawrence Anthony. He's literally a legend in South Africa. He had authored three books, including the bestseller, The Elephant Whisperer. And he was the one who would go in and rescue and rehabilitate elephants all over the globe, and including the courageous rescue of Baghdad zoo animals during the U.S. invasion 2003. He rescued thousands of elephants, and he nurtured them. Well, he just died. Now, this is something interesting. 2 days after he died, a group of wild elephants showed up at his home and with two large matriarchs. This is unusual because they'd never been there. They didn't know where he lived. And they stayed for 2 days. 20 elephants walked miles and miles to get to a South African house. And there's a photograph here of all of them walking in single file. And people who watched this interesting spectacle couldn't quite understand it. And here's what Lawrence's wife, Francosis, said. She said she was especially touched knowing that the elephants had not been to his house prior to the day when he died, but they knew where they were going. The elephants obviously wanted to pay their deep respect, honoring their friend. They stayed 2 days, two nights, and then returned. How about that? And then you think about the people who don't really appreciate the intelligence of animals, and those who trade in their tusks and ivory. Here's a man who saved them, and they knew it. Now to our health and nutrition segment. As you are probably aware, if you listen to this program, I'm a big believer in berries. Raspberries, strawberries, blueberries, boysenberries, pomegranates. This is the latest on blueberries, and it's an interesting article, and here's what it says. When it comes to good nutrition, good to eat and good for you are not always the same thing, but the two definitely coincide in blueberries. And it goes on to talk about how blueberries, in a study since the 1980s, were found to be the number one in antioxidants out of 40 fresh fruits and vegetables, partly because of the anthocyanins, that's the pigment that gives the fruit its distinctive color. And besides helping to neutralize elements that can cause cancer and degenerative illnesses, the fruit has been credited with anti-inflammatory properties, improving urinary tract function, and reducing eye strain. The berries are rich in calcium and potassium, vitamin C and A and E, and they have a lot of fiber, almost 4 grams of fiber, low calories. And so they're suggesting that we should be eating more blueberries. I absolutely concur. I believe that one of the best things we could do is to have blueberries each day, or if not the actual blueberries, because they're not always fresh and in season, then blueberry concentrate. You can buy it in most health food stores. And that has about 70% of the water from the juice removed, no sweetener, because it's naturally sweet. And have 2 tablespoons of blueberry concentrate in whatever smoothie or health shake that you're drinking. That's the latest on blueberries. Now, something we should not be having, as we do, is salt. We eat far too much salt. And here's the latest. According to the World Cancer Research Fund, it says salty foods can increase the risk of developing stomach cancer. So cutting back on salt-laden products like bacon and bread and cereals and meats and the other things we eat that are high in sodium would be good for us. Now, we already know that salt increases blood pressure and increases swelling. And that increases heart disease and increases stroke. But now it increases cancer. There's a bad recommendation on sodium. It's 6 grams a day. That's a level teaspoon. And most Americans eat almost 8 to 9 grams a day. Your body only needs about 800 milligrams a day. So you need about 1/10 what the average person's eating to get what you actually need. Of all the culprits out there, and there are many that cause adverse health effects, if I had to pick one, it would be sugar. And sugar's the top of the list of what causes to become obese, causes diabetes. What can we do? We are not winning the effort of getting people to watch what they eat. And I remember I tried my darndest to get my mother and father and brothers and aunts and uncles to stop smoking. I did not succeed. So knowing they weren't going to stop their coffee and stop their smoking, because where I came from, at least, every single meal, breakfast, lunch, and dinner, when you finished eating, you had to have cigarettes and coffee and sugar in the coffee, and that's what they finished every meal. So what I would do is I would give them vitamin C. In fact, I remember putting vitamin C tablets beside my mother when she would start drinking her coffee, and I'd say, you got to have this. Why do I have to have this? Well, because this will help neutralize some of the adverse effects from the smoking and the coffee and what you just ate. When I was there in front of her, she would take them. When I wasn't, she didn't, because when I'd come back to visit, the same amount that I'd left her with were still there. So you think that maybe people care about their health enough to make these choices. They don't. But let's say you get someone that you can actually work with who will pay attention, but they're not going to stop binging on sugar or having a lot of stuff that breaks down into sugar, like bagels and bread and toast and pastas, all of which break down into sugar. Then give them two things. Now let's make it simple. And the science is really strong to back this up. Two nutrients that can help neutralize and control blood sugar levels. One would be green tea at 200 milligrams. Doesn't matter whether it's white or green or red or oolong. And that can dampen the sugary meal's impact on blood sugar levels. The other is grape seed extract. Now, when you eat a grape, or when they crush grapes to make wine, they put in the whole grape. And that means the skin, the flesh, and the seed. Now, the seed and the flesh are important, but the skin is actually one of the highest nutrients of the whole grape. And if you want to get the probably 80% of the value, it's not the flesh. It is the skin and the seed. Now, most times now they're breeding seedless grapes. Always try to select the seeded grapes. When you crush these grape seeds and you take the nutrients out of them, they're very powerful free radical scavengers. But they do something else. What they do is they impact an enzyme that degrades the simple carbohydrates into their building blocks called monosaccharides. And with fewer monosaccharides available for absorption, there's less of an effect on blood sugar spikes after eating. And that's important because that will help limit the dramatic rise in blood sugar levels. In fact, even paralleling that of insulin. The end result is an insulin resistance and possibly type 2 diabetes. So if you want to help yourself or help someone else, get them to take 200 milligrams of green tea extract after a meal and get them to take 100 milligrams of grape seed extract after the meal. And that will help possibly save their life. Now, there's a new study, a very good study, published in the peer-reviewed journal Gut, and it was done at the University of East Anglia in the UK. And here's what it says. Quote, increasing the dietary intake of certain antioxidants could help cut the risk of developing pancreatic cancer by 75%. And then it went on to talk about the study that it did that proves this. Now, which were the antioxidants they found most beneficial? And they did this on 23,000 individuals. It was vitamin C, vitamin E, and selenium. Selenium is 200 micrograms a day. Vitamin E, tocotrienols and tocopherols, about 800 units a day. And vitamin C, I'm recommending between 2 and 10,000 milligrams of buffered vitamin C a day. So according to this, the article was entitled Dietary Antioxidants and the Etiology of Pancreatic Cancer, a cohort study using data from food diaries and biomarkers, and published in peer-reviewed journal Gut. So for those of you who've been taking your antioxidants, you're on the right trail. And finally, I'm sure you've seen the anti-heartburn ads on television. Well, here's the latest on why you should be concerned, and this is in the Archives of Surgery. Quote, a class of drugs that bring instant relief for heartburn can actually increase your chances of getting cancer. The study suggests that if you take the drug known as a proton pump inhibitors, or PPIs, for more than a year, the risks can include infections, cancer, and heart disease. There were 43 million prescriptions alone for that last year written just in Britain. So the PPIs block the enzymes that make stomach acid so that you produce only about 10% of the normal level of hydrochloric acid. That's not good, because then what you're going to do, you're going to end up having gastric reflux, and you're going to end up having poor absorption of nutrients. So, and try to keep your children on diets, no matter if they scream or yell or don't like it or throw a hissy fit, because if your child is overweight, according to the latest Journal of Cancer Epidemiology Biomarkers Prevention, you run the risk of increasing urinary tract cancers and bladder cancer. Quote, this is from Tel Aviv University, a group of Israeli scientists. Obesity in childhood has a direct link with bladder and urinary tract and colorectal cancers in adulthood. So they're giving you a warning. I'd rather deal with a distempered child's behavior today and get them off the foods that parents, media, and corporate America has put them on, and let them go through a period of readjustment and save their life later, than to feel it's not worth the hassle and end up having a child develop and die of cancer later in life. I'm Gary Nall. That's the latest on health and nutrition. And I'm going to do a brief commentary, come back with our special guest, newsmaker guest, Scott Shackford, who's an associated editor of Reason.com. But I want to share this with you, and then we'll go to Scott. This is from Paul Buchheit of Common Dreams, and I thought it was interesting. He says, the study of inequality in America reveals some facts that are truly hard to believe. Amidst all the absurdity, quote, U.S. companies in total pay a smaller percentage of taxes than the lowest income, 20% Americans. Total corporate profits for last year were almost $2 trillion. The corporations pay just $181 billion in federal taxes, which is 9%, and $40 billion in state taxes, which is 2%, for total tax burden, state and federal, of 11%, whereas the poorest 20% of Americans paid 17.4% in federal, state, and local taxes. So the next time Sean Hannity, or one of the people advocating for less taxes or why the tax break should continue for corporate America, let them know there's real facts and they're hyperbolized facts. Next, the high-profit tax-avoiding tech industry was built on public-funded research. And it's true. I can remember doing a paper in college where we looked back at IBM. That was founded in 1911, and Hewlett-Packard in 1947, and Intel in 1968, and Microsoft in 1975, and Apple and Oracle in 1977, and Cisco in 1984. How do you think they got to become what they are? They didn't create and invent all that. They all relied upon government and military innovations that they got for free. So their combined federal tax payments for the eight companies I just mentioned, 10.6%. You heard me right. 10.6% is all they paid in taxes. Then, this is the most absurd of all. The Bank of International Settlements reported that the total annual derivative trades, which I believe should all be banned, was $1.4 quadrillion. That's $1,100 trillion. The same year, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange reported trade volume of $1.2 quadrillion. So how much tax was paid on that? How about zero sales tax? Zero. Not one penny in sales tax was paid on $1.2 quadrillion. On $1,000 trillions, they never paid a penny. My solution has always been that we should charge them a 5% tax on all derivative tradings, including the nanosecond computer trading. What would that bring in? It would bring in about $100 billion minimal per year. And if you divided that among the states, it would help the states tremendously. By the way, just as an aside, for every dollar of non-home wealth owned by white families, poor people or people of color have only one penny. For every dollar the richest 1.1% earned, they added three more dollars. The poorest, one penny. So that's why we have such a disparity. I'm Gary Nall. Let's go over now, and we're going to ask you, if you have a computer, to watch this video. If not, listen. It's not long. And then Scott Shackford, the associate editor at Reason.com, that I highly recommend you use as a source, will be here to give us their input on it. Now to this video clip.
Police are facing off with an unruly crowd that showed up to protest a shooting earlier in the day. The trouble began late this afternoon with an officer-involved shooting in the 600 block of North Anna Drive near La Palma. KCAL9's Jay Jackson is live in Anaheim with what's happening right now. Jay.
Rob, we're on La Palma and Acacia, where this scene is still a very active scene. Take a look behind me. You can see police cars are lined up here on La Palma, and you're looking west on La Palma right now. Earlier today, there was a scene that was a near riot as police confronted people who were protesting, as you mentioned, an officer-involved shooting. Just moments ago, there was a dumpster fire out here. There was citizens that had shut down the street. Now police have cleared that out. But here's the video from earlier today, which can only be described as frightening. Chaos and violence in the streets of Anaheim. Anaheim police firing rubber bullets confront a crowd of terrified children, parents, and angry residents near La Palma and Acacia. Then one officer unleashes a snarling police dog, which attacks a mother holding her child and this bystander.
I was with my son, and the dog just came.
This is the man that was on the floor.
And the he was on the floor and they shot.
Talk about what happened.
They just released the dog, and I had my baby, and my stroller, and the dog just scratched me with his teeth and then just grabbed me.
It all started around 4 o'clock this afternoon when police shot this man, known in the community as Stomper. Police say he was one of three men who took off running when they approached him earlier in the afternoon.
What exactly happened during the shooting, we don't know. We're still investigating that. But the shooting occurred, and the male was taken to a local hospital.
But neighbors who saw the shooting say police overreacted. Then they confronted the officers, demanding answers. That's when the pandemonium broke out.
We just started shooting again. No, we don't have no guns, nothing.
I just got scared. I just saw a water bottle get thrown in the air. They just started shooting everyone. They shot a little kid, too.
And back live once again, you're looking west on La Palma. This is where police have just broken up a small protest where some citizens had set up a dumpster fire and even shut down the street. Now, out here, there were dozens of people who had their cell phones, and at least four different people told me that police officers offered to buy their video from them without any explanation. Of course, that's all part of this investigation as it continues to develop out here in Anaheim.
So that is an overview of what happened. I watched the video for those of you who just now watched it or need to watch, you can go over to our website, progressiveradionetwork.com, and watch it. What I saw was I saw police firing just a few feet. We're talking about 5, 7, 8 feet away from a crowd of people, unarmed civilians, peacefully protesting on a private lawn, just firing right into them, and then letting a dog, attack dog, on a woman with her child. And then it showed some of the, and by the way, a rubber bullet can kill you, can blind you. The idea, these are not harmless items that they're shooting. And yet, where is the national outrage on this? Also, where's the outrage on the man who was shot in the back for running away? Since when running away from the police, especially in a town that had already shot and killed 7 people in the previous year, and this is an unarmed man, when is this a crime? Because he's black or a Latino? So I'm outraged by this, And I believe that we should pay attention to this as well. And I believe that we should be paying attention to the militarization of the police and how there's a double standard. What you and I can do and be held accountable for, and suddenly the police do something and they're not held accountable. Scott Shackford, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
Scott, would you please give us your perspective on this, and do you see this occurring more and more across the United States, and why is the mainstream media not reporting on how many people have been, their rights violated, their physical bodies violated, how many people have been tasered to death, how many people have been arrested and tasered or shot after being arrested or brutalized, and yet none of this seems to be registering with the American public that we have an out-of-control mindset with the militarization of the police?
Well, it kind of varies a bit. It's a complicated situation. I can tell you from our perspective out here in Los Angeles, it is getting a lot of attention, but you're right. It doesn't seem to be spreading as a national issue, probably because people see it as an L.A. story, and they don't really recognize this kind of behavior happening, you know, in cities throughout the country. And part of that is because when you have these larger communities, these large cities, it's more likely that this is going to happen where it gets videotaped, where you've got a lot of witnesses. And that's really what happened here. There were so many witnesses to this. There's at least four videos of this. There's also there's a video that shows the guy that they shot lying there on the ground dying with police doing nothing, just getting around him and keeping people away. So there's a lot of video of this incident. And so in the LA community, there's a lot of media coverage. It is in the LA Times. It is in the Orange County Register. It's on all the networks.
Okay, but why, Scott, why do you believe that as a society, we have de-evolved to a place where on the one hand, anyone protesting, and by the way, this is not just for the right that considers any protest against authority, the military, or the government to be anarchy and creates fear in them, wanting an immediate reaction, but also on the left. Time and again, they emphasized that if the crowd was, if there's a crowd anywhere, and the left is reporting, especially the official corporate left, it has to be a crowd almost with hymnals singing praises of the establishment, because if you become a person that stands out, speaks out, is angry, they no longer report on that. They don't want to be associated with that because that's not a polite dissident. So the really angry dissidents, those who are defying them, they don't have the coverage either on the left. Your thoughts?
Right, yes. It's really because these are people who don't have a lot of power. And so it's not particularly appealing. In addition, you know, law enforcement, firefighters are looked upon as heroes, and this is something that we write a lot about at Reason. We even have some posts up today about it, that we sort of idolize these authority figures and don't even really deal with their behavior very well when they're not doing what they should be doing. The unions, law enforcement unions, are incredibly powerful with both the left and the right. They donate to both sides. And it creates a situation where leadership, political leadership from both the left and the right, do not have the will to restrain law enforcement agencies because of the money that comes in from them.
That's unfortunate. And I'm seeing more and more of this. I'm hearing more and more about it everywhere I go. And I'm particularly concerned, Scott, because I've just returned from a year and a half of traveling throughout the United States, all over. And I'm doing a new film on poverty, the new poverty, where people with master's degrees, PhDs, are now bagging groceries at $6 an hour in a store or drying a car in a car lot where they had before, you know, they had taught in a university. I'm seeing a whole new dynamic to poverty in the United States. And I'm also seeing that people who are now deemed poor or deemed to be without that power are treated brutally on all levels or ignored completely by the media as if they don't count. You don't have a constituent, you see, you don't have power in the media, power in the body politic, then for 257 million Americans, you don't exist. So whatever the police do to you, whatever the National Guard does to you, whatever, you know, FEMA does to you is, well, it's not important to us. That's the message I'm getting everywhere. Your thoughts?
Yeah, that's, there's a lot of interesting policies that people try to develop that they think that's going to protect the poor, and actually it doesn't, and it makes life, you know, even worse. They think, they say it's to help, you know, help these people. The police will say, and they're saying this, oh, there's a lot of gang activity in that area, and we're just trying to protect people. Well, those people certainly don't feel protected anymore. You know, we see this with the drug war. You know, we're protecting these poor communities from these gangbangers. But the gangbangers weren't shooting into this crowd of people. You know, the police were.
What about the police killing a homeless man in California?
Exactly. Same situation. They believe that they're protecting, or they say, you know, that they're protecting the community from these, you know, from these people who are out there on the street and from panhandlers. And the community now is responding, saying, no, this is not what we want. They're in Fullerton, I'm assuming you're talking about Kelly Thomas in
yes.
Fullerton. The police or the community rose up against that. You know, members of Fullerton City Council were recalled over that. So we are seeing communities stand up like this situation here in Anaheim and saying, no, you are not protecting us. You are not helping us. This is not what we need you to be doing. You are creating an even bigger problem than the gangs and the drug dealers.
Well, I don't see the police protecting the 66,000 homeless female vets in the United States that are living on the streets, that are routinely beaten, raped, and robbed, who have nothing. And only those who know about their male companions in combat who go into the woods where they know they'll be protected. I've actually interviewed hundreds. I've filmed them for my new vets film. And I don't see the police protecting. I don't see the mayors protecting. In fact, I see just the opposite. I see female homeless vets who serve their country. I'm against the wars they fought in. I'm for them. But I see them going to a park, a city park, a veterans park, and being arrested for sitting in a veterans park because they're a homeless vet. I see them standing in line with a paper plate to get some food in Orlando. Shame on you bastards in Orlando and your government there for doing this. Shame on you. And Mayor, you bet I'm going to have you on camera when the next time I'm down there. So you can absolutely bet your life I'm going to expose the way that you treat people, a homeless female vet, and other vets politely, with dignity, standing in line, waiting to get food from a church in a public park where everyone else is having a picnic. Everyone else is giving food to anyone they want. And the police say, you feed these homeless vets, we're arresting you from the church and we're arresting the vets. That's how the police are protecting? That's what they're doing for people, Scott? Is that what the police are doing?
Yes, and they're doing it because that's what they're being told to do. So,
oh, you mean they don't have a mind? Hold on, Scott. Hold on. On this program, I'm going to ask you this again, please. Are you saying because someone was given an order to shoot someone, beat someone, taser someone, pepper spray someone, that they had to do it because they had no free will or had no moral ethics that exceeded the bureaucracy or the line they were told, I was just doing my job? Is that what you're telling me?
No.
Right,
but what I was getting at, is because they're being given these orders, and regardless of whether or not we believe they should follow them, and I don't, that's the defense they're using, and they're being protected by people above them.
If the union heads are protecting, then it challenged the union heads, the corruption in that. Challenge the corruption within the... Challenge corruption no matter where it's at. If you don't challenge the corruption, then it's going to spread.
Exactly, and that's why what happened in Fullerton is so important, that the community responded. The community held the city council responsible for the police officer's behavior, and that is really going to put pressure on the police department in Fullerton to change their behavior. Now, we don't know whether or not that's going to happen here in Anaheim. I think it's interesting, the police, the response from authority figures, they did the usual, oh, we're looking into it, but I have not yet seen any representatives from the police department actually try to defend what happened. So it'll be interesting to see.
Oh, they will.
That typically, you know, they were following orders. But we'll see. They didn't, you know, they tried that in Fullerton and look what happened. You know, people paid a price for how they treated that man.
Well, I believe that every cop who's a bad cop, because we have a lot of good cops in America, I believe that everyone in the law enforcement who steps over that line and does not make a distinction that they're dealing with a human being, and they have to treat that human being in a way that's both reasonable, responsible, that person should not be wearing a badge, and that person should be held accountable. If it means protesting outside of police headquarters, outside the police's home, find out where they live, find out where they go to church, protest outside, then bring the people to the police so they realize that this is a human being you killed. These are people that you sick a dog on. When you sick a dog, when you sick a police dog, and I watched it on a woman who was doing nothing with a baby in her arms, that to me is such an egregious violation of everything that's ethical. But unfortunately, they're going to have all these people from there on down protect them until it's no longer expedient. Then they'll sacrifice someone in some kind of taking away pay or suspending him, and this shouldn't be. Scott, my final thought on this. If you really want to help the people of Fullerton, you want to help the people everywhere in America who are suffering, which is 75% of people, why don't they do something smart in California? Why don't they demand eminent domain, confiscate all foreclosed properties in the United States, every single home, every single community, go through eminent domain, confiscate it. Therefore, the bank doesn't have it. And then through the city, let the person that lived in the house have the opportunity to stay in the house and take what the person can pay as a rent towards the city, helps the city get an income directly. That's something I don't think people have thought about, but it's completely doable and it's completely legal. And also, if they really want to help Americans, here's some simple math. We gave $840 billion to the corporations in order for them to use it by buying up competition, giving themselves big bonuses, and giving additional profit to their stockholders. Not a single home was helped from foreclosure. Not a single small business was helped. Not a single individual was helped. Here's simple math. Hire 15 million Americans. That would mean that 90% of all unemployed would be hired at $50,000 a year. That's a living wage. What does that come to? That comes to a little over $740 billion. Or that's less than what we gave for the bailout and got nothing in return for it. So you see, there are always solutions of what you can do to put people back to work, to help communities, to de-ghettoize a community, to help rebuild the community. Patrolling the streets of a ghetto does not help the people in the ghetto. Rebuilding the ghetto does. Tearing down buildings that are old and putting community gardens, putting in health care centers, putting in counseling centers, putting in crafts and art centers that could be built from the community. There's skilled labor in every community, but we choose not to do it. Instead, we look at all ghettos in America and now all suburbs that are becoming ghettos as crime areas, which we need. We're saying more police, heavily armed, and stronger resistance. And ultimately, who are the victims? The people who live there. So exactly how is anyone doing anything to help any of the problems in America this time? Final thoughts to you. Please share your insights with us.
Well, our perspective when it comes to controlling and dealing with this police behavior is what's going on is eventually going to bear out, and that is people continuing to film this police behavior. We believe that the more people see how police behaves, the less the police departments and mayors are able to defend this behavior. So from our perspective, keep shooting those videos, keep posting them on YouTube, keep submitting them to the media. A lot of people kind of think that the media is protectors of the police, but sometimes it's really a lack of information. So once that information continues to get out, no, it probably won't be a national story. It's unfortunate that you're not going to see this story all across the country. But in your various communities, you're going to see these stories that take place in your community from media that's there instead of as a national story. So you're not going to see this big national movement, but we can see little movements here and there, and they will be effective if we stick with it and if we don't give up.
Scott, you're all doing good work out at Reason.com. I give you a lot of support for that. And I believe that you should. You're absolutely right on. I commend you. Keep keep bearing witness to the crimes against humanity, but it doesn't change the underlying problem. It doesn't change poverty. It doesn't change lack of education and educational standards. It does not change the enculturation, indoctrination, commodification of poverty in the United States by privatization. It does not change the body politic. Those all still have to be addressed. And until we can de-ghettoize America by de-ghettoizing our consciousness and stop this indoctrinating process, that we only have an official solution to all of our problems instead of independent progressive solutions, it will all continue. It just means that the symptoms are addressed, the problem itself is not. Scott Shackford from Reason.com, thanks for being on today.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Gary Noll. Back in a moment with our guest. Please stay with us. Welcome all of you to our program. I'm Gary Noll. Now for our guest segment, the psychological dynamics of authoritarianism and its power as a threat to democracy. I mentioned earlier the background credentials of my guest, Dr. Diana Alstad and Dr. Joel Kramer. Nice to have you both with us today.
It's nice to be here, Gary.
Hello.
Hi. Let us... Since both of you were there at the birthing of the American movement towards challenging authoritarian power, at least for the baby boomers, and you were also the authors of the Guru Papers, Masks of Authoritarian Power, let's begin by taking a look at power and how today power has been, as it always has, corrupting, but it comes in a very slick package. And more often than not, we are enamored by people's personalities, their manners, their smoothness. And at the end of a debate, I heard Keith Urban say, you know, he looked presidential. And I'm thinking, what are you talking about, Keith? I don't care about how someone looks. I care about what is the meaning of their message. Who is this for? How is it implemented? How are they going to help people? Tell us about what we can learn first by going a step back in 1993, when that was written about the Guru Papers, The Mask of Authoritarian Power, and then explain to us, if you will, please, what we have to see in others who we have given the power of choice over to, and determining the difference between their efforts and their results. The forum is yours.
Well, you know, okay, everyone, you know, well, not everyone, but people are aware how power corrupts, and, you know, absolute power, you know, corrupts absolutely. And unfortunately, that the people who are, you know, trying to take over the country, in a sense, and trying to make people, you know, clones for the kind of work that will support their endeavor and make them richer, have a very simple coalescing message that they can force their adherents to obey, which is authoritarian. But from our point of view, authoritarianism is programmed in from, you know, an early age, where we're taught, you know, kids that, you know, that they need adults to tell them what to do, which occasionally they do, of course, but they build mistrust, and therefore people are looking for people who...
They build mistrust for themselves.
For themselves, and people are looking for saviors, for people to lead them, and aren't really questioning, aren't really debating the very important issues that we're facing today.
Right. One of the theses of the Guru Papers is that for thousands of years, religions and societies have inculcated self-mistrust by making them feel guilty for their human nature, which is to partly be concerned with self-interest as well as to be altruistic and social animals. That since Darwin, we know that we're primates, we're animals, we're social animals with a dual nature that's complex. but the moralities that we're operating under always made selflessness being the prime virtue one could aspire to, and egotism and what they called selfishness, which was also just self-protection sometimes, the villain. And this caused a split in people where they mistrusted themselves. They were told they had original sin in Christianity. And once you feel guilty and fearful about yourself, you give your power away to those that claim to be morally superior, selfless, that offer certainty, that are unchallengeable, and that claim to know what's best for everyone. That's our simple definition of authoritarian, is ideologies or people that claim to know what's best for others and are unchallengeable. And they're always offering certainty and coming on as if they're selfless, in the sense that they will take, like, for instance, in politics, politicians are forced to lie, like, to compete with each other, and each claim that they will be more pure and take the ideology of their party into account more than anything, and the citizens, instead of telling the truth, which is to say, look, we're corruptible. We're, all of us candidates are corruptible. You need to create intelligent watchdog mechanisms to protect us once we're elected, so that if we have ideals instead of just self-interest, we can live up to them. We need you to be strategic in voting. For instance, Obama needed the people that elected him to give him a Congress 2 years later that he could work with, instead of being so angry and disillusioned and disappointed and cynical that they didn't even vote and made it ever harder for him to function. So it became a vicious circle. The people need to be strategic politically right now. That's very important.
Well, let's follow up on that for a moment, please, because you talk about, you even said, quote, obvious political authoritarianism based on physical coercion is just the tip of the iceberg, because that kind of control is brutal. It gets all the attention. But covert authoritarian control is far more pervasive, insidious, and dangerous, because it lives in people's minds like a computer virus without their knowing it, unquote. So would you expand and go deeper into this idea of hidden covert authoritarianism, relating it to why today's most Americans are so passive about its rise? For example, no one put a gun to Obama's head and said, you must pass these executive orders or the National Defense Appropriation Act at 9 o'clock on New Year's Eve, and following in Bush's tradition to have specifically lessened individual rights and civil liberties in the disguise of protecting people in the nation. Isn't that also a part of covert authoritarianism?
Well, there's covert authoritarianism in so many aspects of our life and in our minds. It starts as we're children, when parents try to make you feel guilty for being what they call selfish, instead of realizing that you need to be able to take your self-interest into account as well as the interest of others. So our morality is not based on our animal, human nature that's complex. So people grow up mistrusting themselves and giving their power away, which makes them susceptible to media, corporate media control and lies, and Grover Nordquist forcing people to sign a no taxes, no more taxes. This is an example of authoritarianism within the Republican Party. And a party that's run by authoritarianism is sometimes more powerful, because they can coalesce everyone behind them, unless the other side is very strategic and coalesces in a strategic way.
I fully appreciate what you just said. Joel, would you please address this? Because I think this doesn't get enough attention. Politics and organized religion and corporate strategy, all of these are driven by a need to establish some kind of rule and order. And indeed, society does require laws. I recall a very classic early work by Princeton anthropologist Peter Berger called The Sacred Canopy back in the mid-1960s, noting that the laws we need to protect ourselves in turn become our prisons. So first, speak please on the authoritarian nature of law and order by the elite, Democrat and Republican, or an oligarchy who govern and impose it, and then the need of the human spirit for democratic expression to be free to live as one wishes, and why these two antithetical, or are they antithetical?
Okay. You know, we make a very clear distinction between authority and authoritarianism. And we're not against authority, because authority is necessary to hold a social order together. But authority can be either task-driven or what we call power-driven. And a task-driven authority, for example, when you go into an airplane, you want the pilot to have, ultimate control. You don't want it to, belong to, a member of the plane or anything like that. But as soon as that task is done, so is his authority, basically. Then there are power-driven authorities that are primarily interested in maintaining their power. And these authorities are authoritarian in general, the Catholic Church being an example of this. And that people are trained from a very early age, to obedience to authority, whether it be, the social climate or what a small group approves or disapproves of. So that basically in our educational system, which is a big part of the problem, we're trained to repeat by rote what presumed authorities are telling us. And from a political point of view, people like this are easy to manage. The problem is, for example, that an authoritarian party, what the Republican Party has turned into, has a very, very simple, easy message that coalesces a lot of people, while, Democrats fight with each other as to who's right, so that strategically they are not, coming to the bat, as it were, to, deal with what's happening, so that, this runs very pervasive and very deep. And that, it should be very clear that we're not against authority per se. We're against authority that is power-driven and authoritarian by nature, as one sees a lot in terms of who controls the media and how they're given lines that they repeat over and over and over again, without thinking about them, that from, our point of view and perhaps yours too are absurd. And yet people buy them because they have been trained to mistrust themselves, as Diana has said.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you. And Diana, how is our American interpretation of democracy, particularly within our political politic, similar to organized religion? And could you segue from that to one final thought on what I view as a hidden, covert nature of elementary education today, and who benefits the most from it, and what is the ultimate goal for those who push these educational reforms?
Well, religion, monotheism, traditionally has been authoritarianism, just the very nature of God the Father with 10 commandments that are unchallengeable that you have to obey,
and
telling people they have original sin. That's an authoritarian religion. And that religion right now, since the 60s, got activated and politicized in reaction against feminism and abortion and rights and, the various movements, pro-black and things in the 60s. So now that religion and religious conservatives and fundamentalists who are authoritarian have been politicized, they're dominating, unfortunately, one of our political parties in a way that's really unprecedented historically and causing a deadlock. So I think the influence of religion in America right now in politics, which isn't to say, of course, that all religious people are authoritarian or fundamentalists, but what's predominant right now is the authoritarian aspect of religion in our politics. And that's like the origin of this social virus. A lot of it is in the morality that religion puts out and in the obedience and the metaphysics of God the Father controlling you and the commandments. So that's now infiltrated into the core of our Congress and politics. And that's a very dangerous thing. They want to have, ultimately theocracy, many of them, which is the epitome of authoritarianism, where you have religion and the military combined, like you had under Hitler or Khomeini, it's a very dangerous thing that's going on right now in America.
And the and the solution, if there be one, is very similar, we feel, to what you're attempting and to some, in some ways, successful at doing, and that is waking people up to exactly what's happening. We don't see any solution unless people begin to wake up and begin to establish, what your other guest was talking about, establish movements that are taking on all the power. For example, we presumably own the airwaves, but they've been sold out from under us without even a whimper.
Well, we need a movement to take back the people on the airwaves, and they've been given to corporations.
Right, and the idea that a corporation is a human being gives a very few human beings, I don't know how many times, the actual voting power of a single individual. This in itself is authoritarian, not democratic at all.
So one of the things we're saying is that democracy is a recent phenomenon in modern democracy, a couple hundred years old. That's not long at all, and it's way too soon for people to become cynical about it and say they're not going to vote and we don't have a democracy, because for all of its history, it's been operating under the handicap of a citizenry that's got this authoritarian social virus implanted by religion and religious morality.
Well, I appreciate what you have both contributed, not just in the Guru Papers, The Masks of Authoritarian Power, your revised book, which I have always felt was one of the finest books of its type, but a long history of being pioneers in the liberation of our thoughts, challenging us to think differently. And I commend both of you for your continuing legacy in this field, and all the best to you with the Guru Papers. It's needed everywhere. Dr. Diana Alstad and Dr. Joel Kramer. I'm Gary Knoll. For those of you who are coming up the end of the regular program, you can continue listening over the telephone. As it turns out, 68,000 of you are doing. 60,000, that's the figure I just got about 10 minutes ago. At call 832-280-0066, 832-280-0066. Now, Luann Panessi is just joining me in studio. Before we go there, just one little quick program announcement. I will deal with challenging the best diet through anthropology tomorrow. I will also have how bad junk food impacts your DNA tomorrow. And I'll also give you my own insight of what I feel we didn't crystallize yesterday on the open source philosophy and the using the universal brain, something that Robert David Steele and many others have been advocating from the Reform Party, and I'll deal with that tomorrow. I am going to be hiring for 2 weeks only a high-quality gourmet chef, a food stylist, and a photographer, because I'm going to be, I've just completed my newest cookbook. And I've been working at this, but I work each afternoon. I go up for an hour to my store, and this will all be done in a commercial kitchen that I have. So it's easy. So if you want to apply, you can call 646-926-5422, 646-926-5422. That's a chef, a food stylist, and a photographer. All right? And that work starts Monday. Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. You know, I don't have a question from the internet today, but here's what I'm going to ask you. You've done thousands and thousands of interviews, and you've had some people that were probably easy to interview, some that were more of a challenge. Here's my question for you. What makes an interview good? What makes it bad? What makes it great? And specifically, what are the most challenging interviews for you to do?
Well, the best interview for me to do is someone who is an impassioned scholar activist, like a Chris Hedges, a Rabbi Michael Lerner. These people can move on a dime. You give them any idea, and they'll run with it. You give them one question, they'll spend an hour. Last night I did a two-hour special, 2 hours with two people. They each spoke for about 50 minutes each on very specific areas, you know, our militarization around the world, military bases, and then the likelihood of a war with Iran and why. Those are the kind of people who are the best guests. Then you have guests who are great authors. Their books are tremendous. But then they get on the air, and they're not the best guests. They don't know how to put a whole group of thoughts together into a succinct answer. And the ones I don't like at all and try to keep away from are people on book tours. And it sounds like this. Could you explain to us what you mean by X? And they say, in my book. Now, I wrote about that. Now, and I got a chapter on that. And we keep coming back and say, well, could you share it with the audience? At a certain point, there's a line that you can't cross. If you say, look, you were invited on the program not to sell your book, but this program sells more books than any other radio show in America. Tell us the information. Share it with us, please. If you do that, suddenly the audience gets pissed. What are you talking to the guests like that? They're a famous person. They may be famous and may know their topic, but they're not relaying it in such a way. So that happens occasionally. Or you simply end the interview. You do it quickly and you say, well, thank you for coming on. Here's the book. Because you know that no matter what questions you ask and how much time you give them, they're not going to give you the answer. They're there to sell a book. They're on a tour. They have a publisher in the other room looking through the window saying, mention the book, mention the title, mention that you're going to be such and such. And I don't allow that on my show. I'm not here. There are other shows you can go on. There are morning tours you can go on and promote the hell out of yourself. This is about educating people and inspiring people. The worst guests are those who come on who don't know how to encapsulate their thoughts and how to be succinct in giving you an answer that is meaningful. They frequently have arcane answers, and those are not good interviews. Those sometimes are people who are angry activists or who are scholars who have spent too long in academia and not enough in the real world. You give me someone who's been to the jungles of Borneo and who wants to talk about what it is to be living there, that's a good interview. Give me someone who's written a book on anthropology of, you know, of prehistoric nature, that's a boring interview. It's very narrow. And it's very guarded. As a group, lawyers are the most challenging because they stay within very narrowly defined terms. They don't take any risks. Hope that answers that question.
That's brilliant. Thank you.
And that's why we have our Conversations with Remarkable Minds series. That's the best. And that's why we have Progressive Commentary Hour, and that's right beside that. So those are the ones that we feel are exemplary, because you never know what it's like until you're in my shoes. And you realize, I'm listening for the person who's got to understand something, and if you don't lay it out right, they're going to miss it. Or someone else may be more sophisticated or may have a knowledge of that, in which case they're expecting a certain question, expecting a certain answer. If I don't get the answer I need from a person, it's no different being like today. I have to go upstate to film Colin Campbell, the great Colin Campbell. He just watched last week my new film that no one knows about. It's done. It's 100% done. I'm just waiting for the fall to bring it out. And he said, and he's in it. He said, this is the best documentary I've seen. I'm willing to, you know, and he volunteered to be in this other film on genetic engineering. So we're filming today. When I'm sitting behind a camera, I've got to have someone give us information that nails an issue in like 20 to 50 seconds and something that's original, something that bites at the truth. And you have no idea how frustrating it is if someone can't crystallize their thoughts. You take a break, you come back, you do everything you can, and then you pack up at the end of the day and you realize, I just spent $2,000 for this day and I don't have a single thing that's going in the film. So not everybody you have on the air is a good interview. Not everyone I film makes it onto the film. And that doesn't mean they're bad people. It doesn't mean they're not literate. It doesn't mean that they haven't written it. Being able to express it, explain it, to identify it, That's not common. That's what makes good broadcasting interesting.
Well, you make it look easy, Gary.
Yeah. Have a nice day, everyone.